So I want you to just picture the moment you clocked out yesterday.
Okay.
Maybe it was 5 p.m. sharp. Maybe it was, late at night grinding through a deadline.
Sure.
Now ask yourself a question that sounds simple, but is actually incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
Why? Why that specific number of hours?
Most people would just say, because I have bills to pay, or maybe because that's what my contract says.
Right, but what if that decision isn't just about your boss or your mortgage? What if there are these invisible forces, taxes, biology, the price of your time, and believe it or not, the quality of your video games, pulling the strings?
It sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's really just a rigorous macroeconomics.
Today, we are opening up a real heavy hitter from the academic world. We're doing a deep dive into Chapter 12, Labor Supply, by Richard Rogerson and Giovanni L. Violante. This is, it's arguably the definitive look at the mechanics of work.
Yeah, how humans decide to trade their limited time for money.
And our mission today is to decode this labor supply function. We're not just looking at unemployment rates or things like that.
No, we're looking at the why behind the what. Why do Americans work so much more than Europeans? Why do we all work hardest in our 30s and 40s? And, what actually happens in your brain, economically speaking, when you get a raise?
I am so ready to debunk this idea that work is just, a habit we fall into.
And I'm ready to show you the intricate tug of war that's happening in the background of that very decision.
So let's get the lay of the land first.
Yeah.
The authors, they start with what they call stylized facts.
Right. Which is just economists speak for, the big truths that data screams at us.
And the loudest one seems to be the difference between the U.S. and
Well,
pretty much everybody else.
it's a really stark contrast. If you set the US hours worked per person to like an index of 1. Oh, countries like Italy, France, and Belgium are sitting way down at 0.7.
Wow. So you're saying the average person in those countries works about 30% less than the average American?
Yes. Effectively, Americans are the workaholics of the G7 nations. But, and this is the part that usually gets missed,
Yeah.
it wasn't always this way. If you look at the data from 1950, the US actually had the lowest work hours among these same nations.
That is surprising. So
Yeah.
back in the 50s, the stereotype was flipped. We were the ones taking it easy.
Exactly. While US hours stayed, relatively flat over the last 70 years, Europe saw this massive decline. Germany saw a, I think it was a 40% drop in hours per worker since 1950.
So what's going on there? To understand that, we have to stop thinking about work as just one big thing, right?
You have to distinguish between the intensive margin and the extensive margin.
Okay, I saw those terms. Intensive margin is, that's the grind, right? How much you work when you're already working?
Think of it as a dial on a machine. If you have a job, do you work 30 hours, 40, 60? It's about intensity.
And the extensive margin.
That's just a simple on-off switch. Do you have a job at all? Yes or no?
Okay, so if I stay late to finish a project, that's intensive.
Right.
But if my neighbor decides to retire early or be a stay-at-home parent, that's extensive.
You got it. Spot on. And different countries pull different levers to get to that lower number.
Okay, so the geography of work is different. But there's one pattern that seems to be universal, whether you're in Rome or New York. It's this hump shape of the life cycle.
The hill we all climb. Your hours worked, they peak between ages 25 and 54. You enter the workforce, you ramp up, you hit your prime earning years, and then you start to wind down.
But there's nuance in there that feels a little counterintuitive, and that's education. The data shows college-educated people work about 20% more hours, which is a paradox, isn't it? You'd think if you earn more per hour, you could afford to work less, go golfing. But the high earners are the ones putting in the most time.
We will get to exactly why that happens. It's all about how we view our time. But before that, we have to mention the huge gender shift.
Right.
Since 1950, male employment dropped by over 10 percentage points. At the same time, female employment rose by about 20 points.
A complete structural overhaul. Okay, so let's get into the machinery of why. Why does the college grad work more? Why did Europeans work less? The authors use something called the benchmark static model.
This is really the engine under the hood. It frames your life as a trade-off between two things: consumption, so buying stuff, and leisure, your free time.
And the rope in this tug of war is your wage.
Exactly.
So let's play this out. My boss walks in and says, "Congratulations, we're doubling your hourly wage." What's the immediate reaction in my brain, economically?
Well, two things happen at the same time, and they actually fight each other. First, you get the substitution effect.
Okay.
Your wage just went up, which means the price of sitting on the couch just got a lot more expensive.
Because every hour I don't work is now costing me twice as much as it did yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm losing more by relaxing.
Exactly. The opportunity cost of your leisure time just skyrocketed. So the substitution effect is screaming at you, work more, it pays so much better now.
But I'm guessing the second force is the desire to actually, you know, enjoy all that new money.
And that's the income effect. Because your wage went up, you are, for all intents and purposes, richer. You can maintain your exact same lifestyle by working fewer hours. You can buy more leisure.
So the substitution effect says, get back to work, it's lucrative. And the income effect says, take a break, you can afford it.
That is the central conflict. And in macroeconomics, we kind of obsess over how these two balance out. If they cancel each other out perfectly, there's a parameter we call sigma that equals one. In that case, work hours stay constant, even as a society gets richer.
And that balance is key for what they call balanced growth, right? Because if the substitution effect always won, we'd all be working 20 hours a day by now.
Or if the income effect always won, we'd eventually work 0 hours. The fact that U.S. hours have been pretty stable for decades suggests these forces are in a very delicate balance here.
But they don't always cancel out perfectly. So economists have these tools to measure how sensitive we are. The source lists the big three elasticities.
Right. And elasticity is just a fancy word for responsiveness. If I poke the economy with a wage change, how much does labor supply jump?
Okay, let's start with number one, the Marshallian elasticity.
This is the real life one. It's uncompensated. It just measures what actually happens when your wage changes. It lets both the income and substitution effects fight it out, and it just tells you the net result.
That's the bottom line.
Got it.
Next up, the Hicksian elasticity. This one sounded a bit more theoretical.
It is. It's the pure incentives elasticity. It's a thought experiment. Imagine your boss doubles your wage. But at the same time, the government takes away just enough of your money in a lump sum tax so that you don't actually feel any richer.
That sounds like a terrible deal for me.
It's frustrating for you, but it's great for economists. Because you don't feel richer, the income effect is basically deleted from the equation.
Oh, I see.
You only feel the higher price of leisure. So the Hicksian elasticity, it isolates the pure drive to work harder just because the rate of pay is higher.
I see. So this is what you'd use to analyze, you know, tax and transfer programs, where the government is moving money around but also changing incentives.
Precisely. And it's always positive. If I pay you more, but I strip away that wealthy feeling, you will definitely work more.
Okay. And the third one, which seems key for understanding things like recessions, is the Frisch elasticity.
Named after Ragnar Frisch. This is the seize the day elasticity. It applies to temporary changes. So think about a one-time bonus or a massive surge in Uber pricing just for tonight.
Right. So I know I'm not permanently richer. It's just a windfall right now.
Correct. The wealth effect is negligible because it's temporary. You just look at the timing. When wages are temporarily high, you should work like crazy. When they drop, you pull back.
So when the economy is booming, we make hay while the sun shines. That's the Frisch elasticity in action.
That's it. And in a recession, wages might drop a bit and people pull back their labor supply significantly because they're just waiting for better times. It's a key part of understanding business cycles.
Okay, so let's take these tools and go back to that U.S. versus Europe mystery. Why do Europeans work so much less? Is it just la dolce vita? Is it culture?
Well, the source brings up the famous Prescott story from 2004. And Prescott basically says, no, it's not culture, it's math.
Go on.
It's taxes. He looked at the tax wedge. So the difference between what it costs a company to employ you and what you actually take home.
Okay.
In the mid-90s, the effective tax rate on labor was about 40% in the U.S., but it was 64% in Italy.
That's a massive difference. You're keeping way, way less of every dollar you generate.
And Prescott's argument was, if you plug those tax rates into the standard model we just discussed, the tax difference alone can explain almost the entire gap.
Yeah.
It explains why Italians worked about 16 and a half hours a week on average, while Americans were up at almost 26.
So it's not that they're culturally predisposed to relaxing. It's that the government takes such a big bite out of the next hour of work that it's just rational to go to the beach instead.
That is the argument. Incentives matter. But the source also adds another angle from a study by Bick and others.
Mm-hmm.
In poorer countries, people actually work more than in the U.S.
Why is that?
Because the income effect is just dominant.
Mm.
They need to work to hit subsistence consumption levels, you know, just to survive. They don't have the luxury of trading money for leisure yet.
So we have taxes pushing work down in Europe, survival pushing it up in developing nations. But this is where it gets really interesting to me. The source starts talking about something I did not expect to see in a macro paper. Video games.
Yes. The role of technology in leisure. We always talk about tech making work more productive, you know, robots, AI.
Right.
But we forget that technology also makes leisure more productive.
The source cites a study by Aguiar, Bills, Hurst, and Charles. They look specifically at young men.
And they found this fascinating trend. Technology, specifically computing and video games, made leisure time more productive, which in economic terms just means you get more utility or fun per hour.
I mean, that makes total sense. Compare staring at a wall in 1970 to playing an immersive online RPG today. The fun per hour has just skyrocketed.
Exactly. And this has huge consequences for labor supply. If sitting on your couch is incredibly engaging and fun, your reservation wage, the lowest wage you'd accept to get off that couch and go to work, it goes up.
So it's not just that young men are lazy. It's that the alternative to work just got drastically better.
Yes.
If a job pays minimum wage, but the new Elden Ring is really, really fun, the math changes.
It does. And the study suggests this contributed to a decline in the labor supply for that demographic.
Yeah.
But contrast that with how tech affected women.
Right. The washing machine revolution.
We don't just work for a boss. We work at home. Cleaning, cooking, all of that. The introduction of home appliances was a massive productivity shock to home labor.
It freed up a ton of time.
A ton of time, which directly facilitated that rise in female labor market participation we mentioned at the start.
So technology pulled women into the workforce by automating home tasks. And it's pulling some young men out of the workforce by making video games too good to quit.
It's a fascinating divergence, and it's driven by the exact same technological progress.
Let's pivot to something that affects everyone, regardless of their gaming habits. Human capital. The source material, it complicates the model here. It says working isn't just about getting paid today.
Correct. The standard model we talked about assumes you work an hour, you get paid, end of transaction.
But that's not how it works.
No. In reality, especially for young people, working an hour today gives you experience, and that experience raises your wage tomorrow.
This is the dynamic returns idea.
Exactly. A study by Imai and Keen is mentioned, and they show that for a young person, the true return to work is much, much higher than their current paycheck.
That explains why an intern might work 14 hours a day for almost no money.
Right.
They aren't working for the cash today, they're working for the future cash.
They're building an asset themselves, they're streaming capital. But this has a dark side when it comes to policy.
Okay.
If you introduce a permanent tax hike, it's way more damaging in this dynamic model than in the simple one.
Why is that? I would have thought a tax hike is a tax hike.
Because a permanent tax hike doesn't just reduce what you earn today. It reduces the return on all that future experience you're accumulating.
Oh, yeah.
It lowers the value of the asset you're building. So it disincentivizes work both now and for your entire future career path.
That makes so much sense. It's like taxing the harvest and the seeds.
That is a very apt analogy. It really suggests that if we ignore this human capital piece, we might be underestimating how much taxes really hurt labor supply in the long run.
So, we've talked about these smooth curves and elasticities, but real life is lumpy. I can't walk into my boss's office and say, according to the Frisch elasticity, I'd like to work 38.2 hours this week.
No, you can't. And this is the problem of indivisible labor. In the real world, you usually have a binary choice. You either have a 40-hour-a-week job or you don't.
The source calls this lumpiness.
And it creates a paradox. At the individual level, a person might be very rigid. You offer them a 5% raise, they probably still work 40 hours. Their personal elasticity looks like zero.
But if you look at the whole economy...
The economy as a whole can be incredibly elastic. If wages drop just a little bit, a whole bunch of people might decide it's just not worth it and quit entirely, or not take a job in the first place.
So the aggregate response, the total response of the crowd,
mm-hmm.
can be huge, even if every individual is kind of stuck in their rigid schedule.
Theoretically, it could even be infinite. If everyone was identical and wages dropped 1 cent below their reservation wage, poof, everyone would quit at once.
But we aren't identical, and we have bills to pay.
Yeah.
The source also mentions frictions.
Right. It's not costless to change your job. It costs mental energy. It costs money to search. This is optimization friction. We have a status quo bias.
So we ignore the small stuff.
We ignore the small changes in wages because it's just too much of a hassle to react. We only react to the big shocks.
Which must make measuring these things incredibly difficult for economists.
Very. If you just look at microdata, it can look like people don't care about wage changes at all, but they might just be stuck behind these frictions, waiting for a shock that's big enough to make them move.
Okay, let's try to unpack the full picture we've painted here. We started by asking why we work the hours we do. And it turns out it's a pretty complex cocktail.
It is. We've gone from that simple tug of war between income and substitution to this complex web. You have taxes creating a wedge, like in the US-Europe comparison.
You have a life cycle part, building human capital for the future.
And you have technology doing two different things at once, washing machines pushing us out of the house.
And high-quality leisure, like video games, pulling us back onto the couch.
And finally, you have the rigid, lumpy structure of the labor market itself, which forces us into these all-or-nothing decisions.
So understanding labor supply isn't just about laziness or hustle culture. It's about how policy and technology fundamentally alter the math of our lives.
And that math is constantly changing.
Which leads me to a final thought to leave you with. We talk about how better video games raise the reservation wage for young men.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at where technology is going. We're talking about high-fidelity VR, infinite AI-generated content.
Yeah.
Entertainment that's becoming almost indistinguishable from reality.
It definitely raises a provocative question.
If technology continues to make leisure drastically more productive, more fun, more engaging, and if taxes on labor stay where they are, do we eventually reach a tipping point?
A point where the income effect just wins forever, where the opportunity cost of working in terms of all the amazing fun you're missing is just too high.
It's something to mull over the next time you clock out and pick up a controller. Are you relaxing or are you responding to a macroeconomic shift in the productivity of leisure?
Probably a little bit of both.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of work.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.